This is The Guardian.
Welcome to Weekend, a podcast that helps you switch off from your busy day-to-day and find entertainment and inspiration in the best Guardian and Observer writing from the week. You can either listen to this as one podcast or play each article as individual listens. Just scroll down the description on the podcast page for the timings of what we are featuring. Coming up, comedian Sophie Hagen on being celibate for more than 8 years. The £5 coffee is coming, but should we swallow it? And I've lost contact with my brother. Is it too late to reach out? Philippa Perry responds to one reader's plight.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's R-E-B-A-G.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Just a warning, there's a bit of bad language in this episode. Now, Sophie Hagen loves intercourse. So why has it been 3,089 days since they've actually had any? In this edited extract from their book, Sophie reflects on the complex reasons behind their celibacy. Read by Sophie Hagen. This article touches on the topic of sexual assault, which some listeners may find upsetting.
I first had sex when I was 16. I have since had quite a few people inside my body. Some were more welcome than others. Like the surgeon who removed my inflamed appendix and that incredibly hot Dutch photographer in an Utrecht Airbnb to whom I would have given my appendix had he asked. Others have only penetrated me with their words or in my fantasies. Some of the experiences feel unreal, like the guy who referred to himself as Big Mike and claimed that he was moving to Finland the next day, despite there being no packed moving boxes or suitcases in his house. I wouldn't be able to pick him out of a lineup today. I'm torn between two different versions of that story. In one, I was 20-something, wild, confident, and single. I met a hot guy in a bar, and we went back to his place. He read me some of his poems, I elegantly undressed, and we had sex. Twice. The next day, when I was deliciously hungover, I reveled in the fact that we didn't even exchange phone numbers, as if I was in Sex and the City. Then there is the other version, the one in which I felt honored that someone that conventionally attractive was interested. The one in which I was very aware that I was one of the only people left in the bar when he approached me, and I ignored all the red flags, like the obvious lie about moving to Finland, clearly told so I knew this was just sex. The version in which I did leave him my number. He just never called. Though a few days later, a friend of his got in touch and basically requested sex because he had heard I was willing to do it with anyone. In this version, while still at the bar, I desperately drank as much alcohol as I could afford because I needed to drown out the inner voice telling me that I didn't really want to do this. I wanted to feel wanted. I wanted to orgasm. I wanted to feel safe. Instead, I settled for what I thought would be better than nothing. Both versions feel true. Part of me is adventurous. I do love sex. I'm not looking for a relationship. I love my fat body, and I don't particularly need to care about someone to have sex with them. But another part of me is shit scared of intimacy and rejection, of not being desirable to potential sexual partners. Right now, as I speak, I haven't had sex in 3,089 days. If I had known that the last time I had sex was going to be the last time I had sex, I would have looked at the penis a bit more. I would have waved it off like a woman saying goodbye to her lover in 1941, before he went to war never to be seen again. Not having sex seems to be taboo. In theory, I don't think it should be, but based on people's facial expressions when I tell them, it is. "What? How?" they ask, horrified, as if that's not exactly the same question I have for them when they tell me they recently had sex. How? How did you do that? I have a friend who had sex with her Uber driver last week. Another had sex with her boss. People seem to meet in all kinds of places, and I don't know what happens between "hello, my name is" and "shall we have sex now?" So when I want to ask how, I mean psychologically how, particularly if you have been existing in the world as an outcast or a target. Girls are sexualized before they become women. Trans bodies can often be made to feel like cages. Black bodies are subject to violence. The patriarchy rapes, and we're all taught to hate our bodies for various reasons. Aside from this, most of us will have experienced heartbreak, mistrust, feeling unsafe. So many of us are suffering from depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, and more. And while I grew up in Denmark, I have lived in the UK for long enough to know that you people here are mildly sexually repressed. So how do you just do it? How did I just do it? I would, in theory, like to have sex. I have a sex drive. I like orgasms. I like being touched. Sometimes I try. I sign up for dating apps and I swipe yes please to anyone who feels safe. Which is, let's be honest, not that many. Sometimes I get a match. I will open strong. They reply and a wave of discomfort overwhelms me. My abdomen feels tight. I start to sweat. My eyelids are heavy and I don't want to have sex anymore. I delete the app and get into bed under my duvet where it's safe. And I stay there. Unsexed and unfucked. And then it's suddenly been nearly a decade and I wonder what is happening to me and why. I try to explain it to my friends. "It's been a while since I had sex," I begin. "I haven't had sex for 2 months," my friend exclaims hopelessly with a sigh. I'm surprised she's even capable of breathing, let alone speaking, after suffering from such intense deprivation. "Me neither," I say. "It's true. So many 2 months have gone by." She shakes her head. "It's so frustrating." She continues to swipe through her Tinder matches, unmatching with people if they wear the wrong shoes. Meanwhile, I don't remember ever having standards. I have never known how to say no, so I have done some utterly appalling things. I once fucked a man in a bush who had a pregnant fiancé at home, because he pointed at the bush and said, "Wanna fuck in that bush?" And I simply nodded because, what else do you say? Hindsight is beautiful, isn't it? "No thank you," is what you say. You say, "No thank you, I will not be having sex with a drunk, engaged, mediocre comedian in a bush," which will later turn out to have been not much more than a lone ficus, "in central Copenhagen on a Tuesday." What I'm saying is, what shoes people are wearing is clearly not going to be what keeps me from sleeping with them. So what is the obstacle? Learning to love my body is a tricky journey, but is easy compared with learning to trust that other people can love it. When it's just my mirror and me, I can look at my fat stomach, fat thighs, and my double chin, and I can love them with all my heart. Trusting that there is someone out there who would also love my fat stomach, fat thighs, and double chin is a whole different battle. I grew up watching shows like Friends, where fat Monica is the butt of the joke, and Desperate Housewives, where Gabby tricks her chubby daughter into running next to her car because she wants her to lose weight. The same anti-fat message has been drilled into me from the moment I could understand words. And even in the past 10 years, when I have been actively working on unlearning it, it still appears in the comments under my posts on the internet. There is also the fact that my relationship history has been littered with men who have kept me a secret because I'm fat or because they have had wives or girlfriends. Their girlfriends were always thin. I was once waiting at a bus stop late at night, and a guy stopped his bicycle to talk to me. He looked excited to see me, like a little boy at the zoo seeing a giraffe for the first time. He asked for my number so enthusiastically that I gave it to him. As he called the number to check I had given him the correct one, he said, "This is great! I just got engaged, but I've never tried sleeping with one of your kind before, so I want to try that before I get married." I never did sleep with him, but I wonder if the difference between him and many of the people I did sleep with was that he was upfront about it. The others, those who claimed they were stuck in loveless relationships and that, in time, we would be together, probably knew that it was never going to happen, or perhaps they believed the lie, too. The truth is, the underlying insecurity that comes from an entire lifetime of fat phobia is a huge part of the reason I have behaved in ways I do not like. I have never wanted to be the person someone cheats with. I've never wanted to sleep with people I do not fully respect. But the voice in my head, the one that refuses to let go of the fatphobic statements, will whisper things such as, "But what if this is your last chance to have sex? What if he is the only one who wants you?" I have definitely made bad decisions out of desperation. Desperation to be loved and wanted. There have also been times when it has felt as if the bad decisions were made for me. In my early 20s, I remember passing a bottle of rum to my friend Sally, who would slug it and pass it to her friend Eric. He would take a sip and pass it to me. It wasn't until the next day I realized that I only assumed they drank from the bottle too. In fact, they hadn't. That is how I ended up drinking an entire bottle of rum while Eric and Sally remained in control of their minds and bodies. I was drunk. Being fat and quite hardened by the Danish drinking culture meant that I still had some of my consciousness left. Sally left the flat winking at me and Eric, as if this whole thing had been a setup for us to hook up. I remember lying down on his bed and grabbing my phone. I sent myself a text that said, "He has LPs on the shelf, a blanket from IKEA, and you are very drunk." A few seconds later, I received that text. "Good," I thought. "I've informed myself of what's happening here." I remember gathering all my strength to focus on saying one sentence and on saying it with as much force as possible. "Whatever happens, I do not want to have sex." Eric, who was now lying next to me, started sulking. "Come on," he said. Did he pout, or am I just imagining that now in retrospect? I do know that he would not stop pleading. "Come on, please, I just want to go down on you. I love going down on women. Come on, please let me." I said no, and I qualified my no. "I do not want to. Besides, Sally and I have been on a 2-day drinking tour of Copenhagen. I haven't slept and I certainly haven't showered." Eric kept pushing me. "Come on, I really, really want to. I promise it's fine. I don't care how it looks or smells or tastes. I just love it." Fine. My resistance was bothering him and I felt guilty. I stumbled into the bathroom where I tried to wash my vagina over the sink as well as I could. I walked back into his room and laid down on the bed. He placed himself between my legs and began doing what I had specifically asked him not to do only a few minutes earlier. Then he quickly stopped and pulled away. "Ew, that tastes disgusting. Oh, God," he said and lay down next to me. My entire body recoiled in shame. The room that had been spinning around me came to a sobering halt. I wanted to leave my body, float out of the room, and never return. He then had sex with me. I don't remember anything about it other than that it happened. I woke up the next day and grabbed my bag and my clothes. I didn't dare to get dressed, in case he woke up. Instead, I put my clothes on in a snowy Copenhagen street in late December. I met up with Sally to go over what happened. We talked about it as if it was a consensual, pleasant hookup. We giggled and discussed whether or not Eric liked me. I didn't tell her about his comment about my vagina. I didn't tell anyone for over a decade, nor did I let anyone's face near my vagina. I either didn't tell her that I had said no to the sex, or I did tell her and we laughed at how funny it was to make such a comment. It would be years before I realized that it had most likely been planned. That Sally had brought me to her friend's place, that they had decided to get me drunk enough so that she could leave me with him, so he could have sex with me. I learned much later that Sally was psychologically slightly unwell, which is my attempt at not pocket diagnosing someone. Of course, I can't know for sure. Perhaps it was just Eric's doing. Perhaps there was no plan. Eric probably didn't plan on raping anyone that night, and perhaps he still doesn't think he has raped anyone. A couple of months later, Eric texted me and asked if I wanted to go on a date. We hadn't spoken since that night. I said yes and got ready. Did my hair, makeup, the whole thing. I went from my flat in West Copenhagen to a street corner in South Copenhagen to wait for him. I don't recall how long I stood there before I realized it was a prank. He didn't reply to my messages after that and I never saw him again. I felt stupid for falling for it. It wasn't until much later, when I began to reframe the night in question as rape instead of drunken sex, that I began to feel stupid for agreeing to a date with my rapist. It's challenging to write about rape that occurred in 2008. The way we discuss sexual assault, rape, and consent as a society has changed dramatically, and so has my own definition of it. When I was 10 years old, I remember being told that rapists hid in bushes and would jump out and attack you if you walked past. My grandfather told me, in no uncertain terms, that if ever someone tried to rape me, I should kick them in the dick or bite it off. I remember nodding and saying, okay, and immediately internalizing the idea that if I was raped and didn't end up with a bloody penis in my mouth, I probably should have fought harder, and so it was my fault. I did not at the time consider that what happened with Eric was rape, and even now I struggle to refer to it as such. And yet, if a friend had told me the same story, that is exactly what I would have called it. I would have worn a t-shirt that said, "Shut up, you were raped, you didn't do this to yourself, he is a bad man," until she accepted it. But it's not someone else, it's me. And I have this deep lurking feeling that people would get mad at me if I called it rape? That I should take responsibility for drinking so much? For giving in? For not fighting him physically? I changed his name, and there is no way for anyone to trace this story back to the real person behind it. And yet, I feel guilty for telling it. What if it makes him sad? I am endlessly more protective of the men who assaulted me, attempted to assault me, or emotionally abused me than I ever have felt of myself in situations with men. I have reluctantly said yes to sex, even though I did not want to, because the guy wanted to, and I did not want to make him sad. I didn't want to be a prude or a tease. Besides, I knew that a no would be up for debate. "But," they'd start, "you said you would. You were flirting with me. You went home with me. You slept with my friend. You're fat, you can't play hard to get. I came all this way. I really, really want to." All of which are sentences I have genuinely heard after saying no to sex. My boundaries became a hurdle to leap. Still, I do want a sex life. I want a happy, healthy, joyful sex life. So I wrote a book about it, about everything that stands between us and sex. And as I was about halfway through writing it, I got scared. I was afraid that I would discover that I was alone in this, that I was a bit of a freak, and that I am very broken in a very specific way, which would prove to be both unfixable and unrelatable. I nearly let this thought stop me from finishing the book. Then, on a whim, I posted on social media, "Hey, I feel like there is a big obstacle between me and sex. Can anyone relate?" Within 48 hours, I had received 1,800 responses from people of all ages, genders, and backgrounds from all over the world, and I realized that even though none of us had the exact same experiences, trauma plays a big part in everyone's stories. Out of the 1,800 submissions, a total of 30 did not include a sexual assault of some kind. From being flashed at by a stranger on a bus to being repeatedly and systematically raped, they showed me that almost all of us have experienced something that overstepped their personal boundaries. For this book, as well as reading these submissions, I spoke to a relationship and sex therapist, a sex educator, a drag king, comedians, a fertologist, sex workers, porn stars, trans activists and writers to get to the root of the many obstacles to a satisfying sex life. It would be oversimplifying it to say that it's all about trauma. I have also had to come face to face with my gender experience, how my newfound non-binariness makes me feel quite confused. How do I have sex without all the gendered sexual scripts? Not to mention my queerness, or rather my being a 35-year-old queer person who has only ever slept with cis penises. On top of everything, I am socially awkward and often diagnosed by the internet as autistic. But interrogating my traumatic experiences and trauma in general, including from childhood, is my first and hardest step towards figuring all of this out. In exploring this in therapy, things began to make sense. There is something about sex and intimacy that feels threatening to me, or unsafe, or dangerous. So my nervous system gets dysregulated and I go into shutdown mode. This has happened so many times before, and there is something oddly calming about knowing what went on in my body in these situations. I feel privileged that I've been able to get help with this. Sometimes I try to imagine what a future sexual encounter might look like if I take on board everything I have learned so far. I can already immediately rule out picking up a stranger in a bar. It would have to be with someone I already knew a bit in order to feel safe. I would make sure to check in with myself. Do I want to have sex? And if I don't feel present enough in my body to know the answer, it is a no, and I will be brave enough to say no to whomever I am with. Because I no longer suffer fools, this particular person will be very cool with it. They will say something like, "That's okay. I am happy enough just stroking your arm for hours." And also, "My name is Leah Delaria, and I played Boo on Orange is the New Black, and I will now marry you." Shut up, it's my fantasy. I suspect I will eventually feel quite safe with this person. Safe enough that I can exist in my body without feeling scared. Then I might feel turned on and ready to have sex. I will communicate this like a grown-up adult would. And as we go, I will continue to stay present and communicate and listen for signs from myself or from them. Body language, eye contact. And hey, if I no longer want to have sex, I will simply say, "Hey, can we take a break?" And Leah will say, "Of course, I want you to be comfortable, and we will spoon instead. All the while, I am listening to my body and my desires. I set my boundaries and I stay in the moment." This sounds like what sex is meant to be. I have never had that sex before. But if I am ever to have sex again, it is the kind of sex I want.
That was I Haven't Had Sex in 3,089 Days, comedian Sophie Hagen on being celibate for more than 8 years. Written and read by Sophie Hagen. Will I Ever Have Sex Again by Sophie Hagen comes out on the 23rd of May. To support The Guardian and Observer, order your copy from guardianbookshop.com. If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode, we have included details of helplines you can contact on the episode page at theguardian.com. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be back with the second half of this episode in a moment. Don't go anywhere.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Politics can seem quite loud at the moment.
Shut up a minute!
And sometimes even a bit incomprehensible.
They talked about ferrets so much that I was not even able to speak.
To help cut through the noise, Politics Weekly UK is introducing new episodes with me, Pippa Carrera, The Guardian's political editor, and our political correspondent, Kieran Stacey. We'll be bringing you all the insight you need from Westminster to kick off your week. Join us this Sunday, where we'll be chewing over the fallout from the local elections. Subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Weekend. Now, a large takeaway flat white will already set you back £5.19 in London, and other cities aren't far behind. But if cafe owners aren't getting rich off our caffeine habit, who is? Asked Shireen Carle. Read by Colleen Prendergast.
It was one of those London museum cafes where buggies block the entrance and children trail veggie straws across the floor. The queue of parents stretched to the door, and the staff appeared frazzled. I ordered an iced oat milk latte. "That will be £4.50, said the server. I remember the sensations that follow acutely. Shock. How much? Regret. I don't want it. Self-recrimination. Why didn't I check the price? Embarrassment. If I say I don't want it, everyone will hear. Acceptance. I'll pay for it, but I'm never ordering here again. I drank every sip of the coffee, waited for the ice to melt, and drank that too. I was out of sorts for the rest of the day. It wasn't that I hadn't noticed coffee getting more expensive. Prices had uniformly become £3 something, and £4 plus prices were not uncommon. But £4.50 stung, because it was almost £5. A ludicrous sum, I thought, to pay for a takeaway coffee. And yet the era of the £5 coffee is upon us. In London branches of Black Sheep Coffee, a nationwide chain, a large flat white is £5.19. Go into many London coffee shops, add an extra shot to your order, or non-dairy milk or ice, and you'll easily pay upwards of £4.50 for your drink. Where the capital goes, the rest of the UK follows. We're 2 to 3 years away from £5 being routine for a standard coffee, says Geoffrey Young, the CEO and founder of the Allegra Group, which analyses the sector. Certainly we'll see it in the next 5 years, without any doubt. A perfect blend of factors means that having a coffee out is more expensive than ever. First, the beans. We are in a situation of very low stocks in the US and Europe. exacerbated by the Red Sea being blocked, says Carlos Mira, head of the Agri-Commodities Markets team at Rabobank. A lot of coffee comes from Vietnam to Europe, and that now needs a much longer transit time. Brazil and Vietnam, the world's largest and second largest producers of coffee, have experienced adverse weather. In 2021, Brazil had a major frost, while Vietnam is in the grip of a drought. As a result, at the time of writing, Robusta futures were trading at $4,178 per metric ton, the highest ever price for the coffee beans that make up approximately 40% of the world's consumption. Meanwhile, Arabica futures prices have been higher only a handful of times in the past half century. There is not much unsold coffee left in Vietnam, says Mira. Prices may yet increase further before the end of the year, as European roasteries attempt to import beans before scheduled EU deforestation legislation. Coffee production is also likely to be severely affected by the climate crisis, with researchers suggesting that it might halve the area of land suitable for growing beans in coming decades. But the beans are only a small fraction of the cost of a cup. Inflation in the UK began rising in earnest in early 2021, fuelled by the war in Ukraine, as well as the long tail of Brexit and COVID. It peaked at 11.1% in October 2022, a 41-year high, before falling. It now stands at 3.2%. Coffee shops, which use electricity and raw materials such as wheat, cocoa, milk and eggs, all vastly more expensive, and which were, pre-Brexit, often reliant on European labour, have been severely affected. Everything that could possibly have gone up in terms of the base costs of a coffee shop has gone up by around 20% in the last 2 years, says Young. Equipment has gone up, labour costs have gone up substantially, milk has gone up, packaging has gone up, electricity and utilities have gone up, insurance has gone up. Only commercial rents have remained relatively stagnant. According to data from the Office for National Statistics, a cup of coffee purchased from a restaurant or cafe in March 2024 is 19% more expensive than 2 years previously. Consumers are adjusting their habits accordingly. Our research shows that fewer people bought drinks in-store at coffee shops in October 2023 compared with the previous year, 83% versus 89% in October 2022, says Trish Caddy of the research agency Mintel, although more people are buying takeaway coffees from kiosks and drive-thrus, which tend to be cheaper. I don't mind spending money, but I hate wasting it, says Georgia Williams, aged 28, a partnerships manager from London. Williams recently spent £9.10 on two coffees from a local cafe. She only realised how much they had cost when she saw the Monzo notification on her phone. The coffees were delicious, but in future she'll make them at home using her mocha pot. Buying coffee out will be a special treat in the future, she says. It is this exact situation that Paul Ashby, aged 44, a coffee shop co-owner from Leighton Buzzard, fears. If I raise my prices, hoping to get more revenue, am I shooting myself in the foot because you're not coming in as frequently? He asks. We are meeting in one of the three coffee shops he co-owns, the Bogota Coffee Company, in central Milton Keynes. It is a warm and inviting wood-panelled space that serves single-origin Colombian coffee. The week before I visit, Ashby put prices up by about 10%. A flat white has gone up from £3.20 to £3.50. It's a big jump, he says, but unavoidable. His costs have gone up 17% in the past year. The coffee industry has been seen as recession-proof because it's so low spend, says Ashby. But because that spend is getting higher, we can't say it's bulletproof anymore. That's the worry. Ashby places a coffee cup in front of me. On it, he has written out his costs for a £3.50 flat white. 70 pence goes to VAT, 25p for corporation tax, 50p for rent, 35p for wages, 27p for coffee beans, 15p for milk, 15p for utilities, and 7p for the cup, lid and sleeve, leaving £1.06 profit. I visit on Monday, the quietest day of the week. In the hour I spend there, I estimate that 20 people buy coffees, equating to about £21 profit. I do not want people to think I'm pleading poverty, because I'm not, says Ashby. But this is a lifestyle business. If you're hoping to get rich out of it, you're not going to. It's easy for independent operators to get into a financial mess. A one-off independent is often a passion project, says Young. They don't have the cost controls a large-scale operator can put in place. They don't have the marketing reach. They are not in the highest footfall locations because landlords can't take the risk. It's very hard to make money. Despite not having the same economies of scale, independent coffee shops have to match or even undercut the major brands. The chains set the price, says Professor Jonathan Morris of the University of Hertfordshire, the author of Coffee, A Global History, and the host of a podcast called A History of Coffee. Many of the chains have put up prices by above inflation in recent years, sometimes by startling amounts. Well-established brands with strong pricing power have been able to raise menu prices without losing market share, particularly among 16 to 34-year-olds who are willing to pay more for their favourite brands like Costa Coffee and Starbucks, says Caddy. According to data collected by the coffee retailer UCC, a medium latte in Buckinghamshire branches of Starbucks went up from £3.20 in January 2023 to £4.50 in January 2024, a 40% increase. The fact is, the independents don't have the confidence to charge what they should be charging to have a commercial business, says Young. Whereas the likes of Costa, Starbucks and Nero are charging what they need to charge. The Bogota Coffee Company remains profitable because it has a well-established customer base, many of whom Ashby knows by name, and because he is on top of his costs. We don't waste anything, he says. We know exactly how much to put out on the counter every day. We know exactly how much milk to order. But even the most well-operated and beloved coffee shops can founder. Until lockdown, we were all right. It was never going to be a business you can retire early on. But we were okay, says Sharon Henderson, aged 44, from King's Winford, near Dudley. Henderson opened the Red Cone Coffee House in Wordsley in 2013. She had previously owned and sold a successful coffee shop in Kinver. I went in with knowledge and experience, she says. The Red Cone was a charming, rustic cafe known for its cakes in particular. We baked everything in-house, she says proudly, in the tiniest kitchen you've ever seen. The Red Cone was within a heritage attraction. It relied on tour groups, which COVID decimated. Then came the cost of living crisis. Henderson's electricity bill tripled overnight. A single egg went from 6p to 20p. We couldn't pass those increases on, she says, so we were always absorbing the costs. She put up prices, but there was a ceiling to what customers were prepared to pay. To make matters worse, renovation work began at the heritage site and the scaffolding put off customers. In January 2024, Henderson took the heartbreaking decision to close. I tried to be very dispassionate and unemotional about it, which I didn't succeed in because I cried in the bath. She felt like a failure. It's soul-destroying. Having to tell her staff they no longer had jobs, she says, was horrendous. They were all wonderful. They knew, because I never kept it secret, that I had done everything I could. But that was the worst thing, she says. The British have an enduring love affair with coffee, dating back to the 1650s, when coffee houses arrived in England. They spread very rapidly and became important spaces for socialising, says Morris. But coffee houses disappeared in the late 18th century, being replaced by pubs or private clubs. There was a limited revival with Italian-style coffee bars in the 1950s, but it wasn't until the 1990s that coffee shops took off once again in the UK, led by chains such as Starbucks. Throughout the 2000s, independents pioneered Australian-influenced drinks such as the flat white and began procuring speciality beans. According to the Allegra Group, there are now more than 22,000 coffee shops in the UK. We are making a better product, says Young. Customers are getting a pretty good deal. But sometimes the experience falls short. Sullen staff, cold coffee, dirty tables. This is Ashby's pet peeve. You go to sit down and it's a sticky table, he groans. It's the worst. When this happens, particularly if your drink is expensive, it transforms a restorative ritual into a frustrating experience. It is likely that outlets like these will be winnowed, as price rises force customers to think carefully about where they spend their money. Independent places sometimes take their foot off the gas, says Ashby. Are customers still having a good experience? Are you taking them for granted? Independents cannot survive without their regulars. He points out a woman by the till. She comes every day, he says. She's a really good customer. If we were to upset her, it would be really difficult to replace that revenue. Larger chains can afford unhappy customers as attrition is priced in. As I was leaving, I thought, have I just been conned? Nick Green, aged 50, lives in Ipswich and works for a bank. He has just paid £5.19 for a large flat white at Black Sheep Coffee in the City of London. Green placed the order on a touchscreen menu during the lunchtime rush. I looked at the price and thought, is that right? He says. But there was a queue of people behind me. I didn't want to look like an idiot and back out. The issue for Green wasn't the cost. It's a value thing, he says. I wasn't waited on. I didn't get a china cup with a little biscuit on it. I got a plastic cup with a lid. I couldn't see if there was latte art or not. I did the work myself. I ordered it and queued for it and left. The best coffee shops are also about atmosphere, the hiss of the milk steamer, the conversation drifting from other tables. You don't go to a coffee shop to buy coffee, says Morris. You go to the coffee shop to buy the experience of being in a coffee shop. When all that is stripped away, even the creamiest latte will leave a bitter taste in your mouth. Consumers don't tend to complain, they simply never come back. You literally and figuratively swallow it, says Green. Done well, coffee shops are vital community spaces, where for a few pounds mums with prams and pensioners and office workers can meet and talk. It's a hospitality venue, says Ashby, as the milk delivery man arrives and leaves with a free coffee and a cheery wave. It's not a coffee shop, really. It's about coming in and feeling welcomed, about having a nice place to go. The £5 coffee is coming, perhaps not today, but soon enough. And when it arrives, coffee shops may not seem like extensions of our living rooms, but more rarefied spaces, like restaurants or bars. Customers are not ready to pay £5 daily for a regular coffee, says Young. If they do balk, more well-loved independents like the Red Cone will falter. If we don't support independent businesses, they will be gone, warns Henderson. We are open to the elements. we are on our own. She now works as a baker. It's tough out there, and this time my business didn't survive, she says. Would I do it again? I don't know. Coffee shops disappeared once before from UK shores. In an era of capsules, sachets and worktop espresso machines with high-quality coffee easier than ever to make at home, whether the neighbourhood coffee shop will survive the dawn of the £5 coffee remains to be seen. Coffee's always been an affordable luxury, Ashby says. You don't really think about it, whereas now you are thinking about it. And that is the problem.
That was The £5 Coffee is Coming, But Should We Swallow It? By Shireen Carle. Read by Colleen Prendergast. Finally, every week, psychotherapist and author Philippa Perry addresses a personal problem sent in by a reader in her Ask Philippa column. This week, we hear from a woman who is trying to come to terms with the estrangement of a sibling. Read by Philippa Perry.
I get a lot of email from people who have trouble with their relationships with their siblings. And I'm talking about adults here, not kids. And this is such an email that I'm going to read to you now. Since our mother's death, my brother and I have had no contact. He lives more than 100 miles away. Our relationship has been very difficult for over 40 years. When we both had young children, things were better for a time. When our dad died, Mum's health deteriorated and she moved in with me and died 12 years later. During this time, my relationship with my brother was at its worst. Before retirement, we both worked in mental health, but neither of us understand why our family relationships have been so fractured. There is a family history. Our grandfather did not get on with his sister. He and his wife kept secrets, and our dad fell out with his twin. Our childhood was difficult as our father had mental health issues. Friends who know the story advised me not to pursue any reparation. Another friend suggested I write to you. Since Mum died, I have sent Christmas cards and occasional texts, but have received no reply. I've attempted to contact my nephews, again to no avail. Should I accept that there is too much water under the bridge and stop my attempts to contact him? And this is what I replied to that person. People, including myself, are often drawn to work in mental health, precisely because they have had their battles with it. I'm just throwing that in there. Children do seem to carry the baggage of their ancestors. Fractures, like the ones you have a history of in your family, are often caused by the family's style of parenting. For example, by parents not taking seriously any feelings of jealousy when a younger sibling comes along and not intervening except punitively when that jealousy plays out. Older siblings who feel displaced need to be dealt with sensitively, and if that doesn't happen, they may resent their younger sibling. After a while, the younger sibling then grows to dislike the elder because of how they were habitually treated by them as children. This may cause them to stay away, perhaps without really understanding why that is. Another parenting style that leads to trouble is when one child is pitted against the other, perhaps by comparing them or making them compete against each other. Overt and covert favouritism and making one child the scapegoat for any disharmony are other habits that can give rise to feelings in siblings that become so entrenched their unconscious inclination is often to stay away from their brother or sister. Parenting styles tend to be inherited if the next generation doesn't consciously decide to break these patterns with their own children. Siblings can have very different memories of the same events, and it can often seem that brother or sister doesn't validate their experience. And when you're not validated by someone important in your life, it may feel almost as if they were trying to wipe you out. Now, I don't know if any of this is a fit for your relationship with your brother, but I mention it in case it is. Even though your brother may have had no desire to nurse his mother in her old age, it may well have brought up a very old feeling of jealousy inside him because you had her all to yourself. Or perhaps he felt guilty about you doing all the caring. When we have these hostile tendencies towards siblings, the roots of them can be forgotten, yet the feelings can still remain. What we often do to make sense of such feelings is to get into the habit of thinking about our sibling with judgment and criticism, and so sometimes it just feels easier to stay away. We are closest to the people in whose company we feel relaxed and unselfconscious. Then we feel good in ourselves when we are with them. If being around someone causes us to feel shame, it is normal to avoid them. People often feel shame that they have a sibling who isn't a friend, because they feel they should have a close relationship with them. Lack of understanding causes shame. So if you can't figure out why you feel as you do towards a sibling, perhaps this is a source of shame too. And if you're feeling any shame because your brother is staying away, then you can tell your inner critic, the usual source of shame, to pipe down. You and your brother may be very different people despite coming from the same family and having had similar jobs. Would you be friends if you were not siblings? Do you have different ways of looking at and reacting to the world that don't make you particularly compatible? Or perhaps you just don't get each other? Seeking reparation may be too ambitious, but perhaps you could seek more clarity. Perhaps you could tell him that you want to further your understanding of the rift so you could stop ruminating about it. Warning, tough feedback might be involved. Perhaps send this column to him. Work out why it matters to you so much. Perhaps by seeing a psychoanalyst. It is common for siblings not to be close, and there may be no reason why you should be.
That was Ask Philippa. I've lost contact with my brother. Is it too late to reach out? Read by Philippa Perry. Now, if you listen to Politics Weekly UK, you might want to know The Guardian is introducing new episodes with Pippa Creera, The Guardian's political editor, and political correspondent Kieran Stacey. They'll be bringing you all the insight you need from Westminster to kick off your week. The first episode is out this Sunday, where they'll be chewing over the fallout from the local elections. Subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes will be published every Monday. That's all from us. This has been Weekend, a Guardian podcast. If you're enjoying it, please make sure to like, subscribe to, and rate the podcast. Maybe even leave us a nice review. Or let us know what you want to hear more of. Just search for Weekend wherever you get your podcasts. This week's articles are read by Colleen Prendergast, Sophie Hagen, and Philippa Perry, and presented by me, Savannah Ayode-Greaves. This episode was produced by Rachel Porter. The executive producer is Ellie Bury. Join us again next Saturday. Thanks for listening.
This is The Guardian.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.